Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness.com podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield with a special guest for today's podcast. And there was actually a recent article in Men's Journal on my guest today. And here's just a snippet of what Men's Journal had to say. Few people have subjected their bodies to as much wear and tear as this Manhattan chef and restaurateur. The mastermind behind the red-hot Manhattan restaurant, Tertullia, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that properly, and a regular on the Food Network, he has seen it all. He contracted dengue fever on a mountain bike trip across Costa Rica. He was bitten by a vampire bat while cooking at an eco lodge in the jungles of Venezuela, an injury that required an emergency helicopter trip to the closest hospital. He spent 5 months on a punishing 11,000-mile dirt bike trek from San Francisco to Panama and back. There have been bike races, cyclocross challenges, and mountain bike half centuries, not to mention years of brutal 90-hour work weeks in high-end restaurant kitchens all over the world. Well, it may sound like I'm about to interview somebody who's just a daredevil chef, but in fact, he also has a remarkable journey from fighting back from rheumatoid arthritis and chronic pain and gut inflammation and a ton of really serious health issues caused by a combination of bad food and modern medicine, pharmaceuticals, and some of the things we'll talk about today. And he is now well on his way to peak fitness, being in the best shape of his life, and completely changing his body primarily by eating the right foods and fixing his approach to our medical system. So Seamus Mullen is my guest today. He's the author of Hero Food, How Cooking with Delicious Things Can Make Us Feel Better. And Seamus, I want to welcome you to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be here. I'm a huge fan of the show and an avid listener.
Well, I'm excited to learn some really cool lessons from a guy who apparently cooks very delicious food. And I know we'll get into that too, how our listeners can cook some of the delicious things that you use to heal your body. But first, I want to delve into your story and kind of hear about how you more or less got messed up as far as your body and your gut and your joints go, and what you did about it and how your journey progressed.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been a pretty wild journey, as you got a sense of from that article in Men's Journal. And you have to forgive me, I've got a little bit of a cold, so if I sound kind of stuffed up, you got to get over it. I'm getting over it. I'll try not to cough in your ear. But my relationship with food, I mean, with all of us, our relationships with food begins the moment we come out of our moms, and that's the beginning, right? Or perhaps it even starts before that. Mm. And I was lucky that I grew up on a small farm in Vermont. I was exposed to really, really good food for the majority of my early childhood. And then my parents made a decision, because I was living in such a rural environment, to send me away to boarding school. And my brother and I went away to boarding school. And in hindsight, you know, I've spoken with my mom about this quite a bit. And she said she knew that when they made the decision for us to go to boarding school, that they were going to lose control over what we were eating. And that was a really big issue for them. And in fact, I learned that, you know, years later, that was a real big issue for me as well. Mm. And it was my first exposure to kind of industrial institutional food. You know, I'd had a very, very clean upbringing in so many ways. And it's funny looking back, because it was one of the most positive experiences of my life going to boarding school. I met people that were just incredible people. But I also think it was the beginning of really a slow kind of descent into poor health. Even though I was athletic and I was really fit, when you're a teenager and you're going through puberty and you're going through change, it's really when you need to be nourishing your body more than ever. And in a private boarding school in the late 80s, early 90s, we were eating Cisco junk. I mean, it was total garbage. Yeah. And I actually got my first real major issue. I got salmonella in 1991, I think. Mm. And there was an outbreak at my school and a whole bunch of people got sick. And it took me for a really, really long time to get over that. And just kind of when I was starting to feel back on track, then I got dengue fever in Costa Rica 20 years ago. And that was kind of the beginning of what was really, really traumatic for me. The whole time, though, I was very physically active and I was an athlete. I was racing mountain bikes semi-professionally all through the 90s. And but, you know, still struggling with my health. And it got to a point where in 2001, I got very, very sick in Mexico. And when I came back from Mexico, my health just really rapidly started to fall into the gutter. And I didn't know what was going on. I mean, I just felt crappy all the time. My body ached. At this point, I was working a lot as a chef. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of attributed how I felt to the lifestyle, to my job, my profession, everything that I was doing. And I actually, you know, I would bring this up with my doctor and there was not really any kind of response like, well, you need to rest a little bit more. Never was there any question about what I was eating, first of all, or my lifestyle. And then I started developing these really horrible acute flare-ups, which I now know are flare-ups. I didn't know they were flare-ups in my joints, and started in my shoulder, and then it would go to my wrist or my knee or my hip. And I went to the hospital many, many times, the emergency room. Wow. And I was just, you know, with inflammation that was felt like a knife in my shoulder. I mean, in horrible pain with no trauma whatsoever. And they'd give me some pain medication and some anti-inflammatories and send me home and tell me that there was nothing really wrong with me.
Wow. Just like an ibuprofen or an Advil or something stronger than that? Or?
No. I mean, they were very, very quick to hand out Percocets and Vicodin and, you know, hardcore pain medication, which got me through it. In fact, with my shoulder, they multiple times would give me injections of cortisone directly into the shoulder to try to quell the inflammation.
Yeah.
But no concern or question about what might be causing it. And it eventually got to the point where I had an attack in my left hip that was just excruciating. My friends took me to the ER, and they tried to send me home, and I couldn't walk. I mean, they tried to stand me up on both my feet, and I collapsed. The pain was just beyond belief, and so I was admitted to the hospital. And over the next 5 days, I was just in excruciating pain and under observation. They had no idea what was causing this pain. And eventually, I convinced them to give me an MRI, which they did not want to do because it's very hard to get approval through the insurance company to get an MRI if there's no real rationale for it.
Right.
But the MRI, basically, they had to sedate me to give me the MRI. And when I came out of sedation, I was in an operating room and I was like totally confused. I had no idea how I'd gotten there. And my body was covered in Sharpie marks. They were like about to cut me open.
Oh my goodness.
And you know, this is pretty insane. And fortunately my brother was there who's been just an incredible pillar of help in my life. And he said, listen, we have to make sure. What they found in my hip is that my hip was full of fluid. And my white blood cell count was extremely high. It was like, you know, in the 40% or something like that. And so they thought that I had a septic hip, that I had somehow gotten an infection inside my hip and it was going to go to my spine.
Right.
And they needed to perform what's called a pelvic evacuation, where they basically split you open and they scrub you out and sterilize you. And God knows what the effects of that are.
Yeah, that does not sound fun.
And button you back together. And that's when my brother said, listen, we need to make sure this is actually, there's an infection there before you do that. And so they performed a culture and found there was no infection.
Really?
And that's when they reached out to every department of the hospital, and the chair of rheumatology came back and said, I think this guy has rheumatoid arthritis. He's got all of the symptoms of it. I need to see him and I want to run tests. And that's when they ran tests on me and I was diagnosed with RA. And then the next 7 years of my life have been kind of living with RA and what that meant. So it was a pretty intense road to diagnosis.
Now, you know, as far as rheumatoid arthritis is concerned, I mean, some of that can obviously be genetic, but how much did food, inflammation, and your gut play a role in this as far as, like, you know, digging that you did to kind of look into what may have contributed to the flare-ups and maybe aggravated the rheumatoid arthritis?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that for me, when I was diagnosed, I had no idea what the disease was, and I didn't know, as most people don't know, that RA is an autoimmune disease and it's a systemic inflammatory disease, so it's very different from osteoarthritis. And it, as you rightly pointed out, it can be caused by many things, and they're still slow to acknowledge exactly what may be causing RA, and there are certainly genetic markers that can make you more predisposed to it, or so it would seem. But it seems as though, and there's a lot more compelling evidence out there now, that it can be driven by some sort of ulterior infection or inflammation caused within, whether it's in the gut, maybe it's a viral infection, something that kind of causes the immune system to spin out of key. Mm. And in my case, I mean, I didn't know any of this and I didn't realize any of this until about a year and a half ago. I was very fortunate to be introduced to Dr. Frank Lipman, who practices functional medicine. And Frank was the first doctor I'd ever seen probably in my whole life who, when I first met him, and I wasn't even planning on seeing him as a doctor, we met socially. He said, "What's going on with you?" And I kind of told him my story. And he said, this is a freaking shame that you've been through this.
And this was just last year.
This is about a year and a half ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I think that we can get you feeling better. You know, it's going to take a little bit of time, but I think we can help you to feel better. And I never had a doctor say that to me before, that was willing to actually, you know, put his money where his mouth was and say, you can get over this. We can get you past this. And his suspicion was that in 2001, when I got really sick in Mexico, that I contracted parasites.
Really?
Yeah. So he sent me to a parasite.
So did he think that right off the bat, based off his experience, that just because the whole parasite to rheumatoid arthritis link seems almost far fetched, unless he'd already known that could happen.
Well, his, you know, in his practice, what he's seen with so many different presentations of autoimmunity, mm-hmm. that there's actually that we compartmentalize diseases. We say, okay, this set of symptoms belongs to lupus, and this set of symptoms belongs to IBS, and the symptoms belongs to MS.
Right.
And what he you know, really believes is that a lot of times these presentations are different reactions to a similar cause. And if you treat the root cause, then you can, in theory, you can help the body heal and get over some of these symptoms rather than just symptomatically treating the issues on the outside.
Gotcha.
And so what he, you know, in my case, it wasn't like initially like, oh, let me see what you've got going on. I think it's parasites. He went through all of my medical history, looked at absolutely everything. And, you know, I gave you a very kind of Cliff Notes version of what my medical history has been. But I've had all sorts of weird things happen to me, you know, from blood clots to an infection in my brain that nearly killed me. All of these things that seemingly to most Western doctors were very unrelated, and they weren't able to come up with any kind of answer. But to Frank, he looked at this and he said, "I think there's an infection, and there's some sort of infection in your system that is appearing when your body is compromised, when your immune system is compromised, and it's receding when your immune system is able to handle it a little bit more. But your baseline is pretty crappy. And what we need to do is find out what that is." And so when he kind of poured through all of my medical history and he came to the sickness in Mexico, he said, "Aha, you got sick and you never really got better. And then your health really started to decline after that. That tells me that possibly there something could have happened in Mexico. And what I think it might be is it might be parasites." So that's when he sent me to see a parasitologist.
Wow. So this is a year and a half ago. You go to the parasitologist. You've already got this rheumatoid arthritis that you've been living with for how long was it at that point?
Well, diagnosed for 7 years, but living with it in terms of symptoms for at least 10.
Right.
And for 7 years on pretty hardcore medication, everything from chemotherapy drugs and prednisone to biologics, autoimmune immunosuppressants, all that stuff.
Okay. So the parasitologist actually finds that you have a parasite?
Yeah, he finds that I've got not one, but, you know, I've got a whole colony of them living throughout my body, wow. throughout my digestive tract. And so what we end up doing is first a very kind of heavy artillery job of trying to wipe those guys out, which is pretty unpleasant, but we definitely made really good progress. But I still didn't feel a whole lot better.
Well, I've had a parasite before and been given by my naturopathic physician a basic berberine golden seal kind of Chinese herb complex to successfully knock it out. But, you know, and this was in this case a blastocystis parasite. And that is actually something that's pretty common for even a lot of folks who are just living in a regular old, you know, American or Canadian or kind of safe city to quote unquote safe city to have. For you, was this issue because you were off, like, you know, in the wilds of Panama and Costa Rica and Venezuela, or were these type of things that were found in your body something that were relatively common for a physician like this Dr. Frank Lipman to actually come across?
I think in my case, it was something that I developed a very long time ago and contracted in, you know, in a tropical environment. Mm-hmm. And then just over time, the issue actually, I think, is probably less so the parasites, because, you know, a parasite doesn't really want to kill you. It wants to live off of its host. Yeah. But unfortunately, parasites are not, they're not alone. You know, they create a lot of bacteria. There's bacteria that live on them. And that's really where I think the issue was. And I think that's where, you know, what's really fascinating to me is this whole notion that the bacterial kind of movement in medicine. And that's really, I mean, I think that's the future of medicine. I had a meeting a couple weeks ago with Dr. Dan Littman, who's a researcher at NYU, and he recently published a paper linking specific gut bacteria in rheumatoid arthritis patients. And it's the first real conclusive study to link the two together. And he and I were talking about kind of the future of medicine. He feels very, 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 very he convinced that shortly we're going to be using, you know, we can call them probiotics now, but basically, you know, bacterial implants or fecal implant or bacterial seeding to change, because he's been able to see someone's microbiome go from 90% dominant with one bacteria to 10% subordinate change overnight by changing the diet.
Yeah, the infamous poop pill.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I get what you're saying, that there are multiple ways to get to a gut imbalance or an imbalance in your bacteria or what's called your gut flora. And in your case, it turns out that a big contributing factor was this parasite. Mm-hmm. So before we jump into how you balanced your gut and some of the things you did to address the gut flora issues created by this parasite, because I know a lot of listeners out there actually have joint pain and brain fog and a lot of issues that could be related to gut flora, and I think what you say will help them out. What'd you do about the parasite? Like, did you take some kind of a pharmaceutical? Did you use herbs or what was the protocol for that?
Both. Both. We used both herbs. So the idea was to use a heavy-duty pharmaceutical to wipe it out, and then backing that up with herbs and supplements, and at the same time doing a very kind of a gut-healing anti-inflammatory protocol with supplements and diet.
Okay.
At the same time. And it really was, I mean, it's funny, Frank told me, I think it's going to take 6 months until you feel better. And it was almost 6 months to the day that I woke up one morning. And I literally had like a hallelujah moment. I woke up and I was like, oh my God, I'm not in pain. And it was the first time in 11 or 12 years I'd woken up and not been in pain.
Wow. Amazing.
It was absolutely amazing. I mean, my wife literally cried. She had never heard me say that. I mean, for years, when people asked me how I was doing, I said, I'm okay. I'm all right. You know, literally the notion of actually feeling great was something that was so foreign to me. And I'd completely forgotten what it was like not to be in pain.
Yeah. Wow. So the rebalancing of the gut, you'd obviously been on prednisone, you'd been on a lot of things that I think our listeners might already be aware of can do a number on your gut and your stomach.
Mm-hmm.
What did you go about doing as far as balancing your guts? You know, what kind of gut healing protocol kind of worked for you?
Well, I mean, the first thing was to try to reduce any inflammation via the foods that I was eating. So, you know, that involved a strict kind of elimination of anything that was processed, which I was already not. I mean, I wasn't eating very much processed food, but cutting back on processed carbohydrates, and then really just getting almost, you know, most carbohydrates out of my diet.
You were still cooking and living as a chef at this time,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, and that's another kind of challenging piece of it for me is that as a chef, you have to taste a lot of food and you end up not really eating at regular intervals, which is not, I don't necessarily think you have to eat 3 square meals a day. In fact, I think that's kind of a weird convention that we've invented. But I do think you need to be very considerate about how much food you eat and when you're eating that food. And when your main preoccupation as a cook is to make sure that everybody else's food tastes really good, you end up eating a lot more than you necessarily need to, and eating when you don't necessarily need to, like late at night, right before going to bed, which also didn't help me balance my gut. So a big change for me was just being really considerate about how and when I was eating, and then eliminating things like sugar and gluten and carbohydrates from my diet.
Now, obviously, elimination is kind of one key to healing the gut, but there are obviously other things you have to do to, like, you know, heal the lining, heal the cells, you know, basically seal up the cellular junctions, all this stuff. What kind of things did you do from that standpoint?
I still take L-glutamine. I take krill oil. A lot of supplements I took on a daily basis, anti-inflammatory supplements, things like curcumin, high doses of curcumin, cat's claw, Amazonian cat's claw. I started looking, you know, going back about a year and a half ago, I started looking at my blood panels very, very regularly and seeing where I was deficient, what I needed to increase, doing this in conjunction with Dr. Lippmann, making sure that I was taking, been taking high doses of vitamin D with vitamin K for now over a year. Across the board, just initially a cleanse that was 2 weeks and then went into another 4 weeks, so ended up being about 6 weeks of just really gentle food consumption coupled with a lot of anti-inflammatory supplements.
Okay, gotcha. So you did a cleanse, you did kind of a gut reboot, you did this gut healing protocol. Were there other things that you did to heal your body from the inflammation caused by rheumatoid arthritis and years of unhealthy eating and parasite?
Yeah, I mean, I did, movement became really important to me. Certainly, acupuncture helped a lot. For I would say about 9 months, I was doing acupuncture at least once a week, and focusing mostly on major sort of both digestive and immuno points, body work. Whether I was doing ART, I mean, a lot of the issues that happen with joint inflammation are develop muscular imbalance and lack of mobility. And I've had major inflammation in my shoulder and my knee and my hip, as well as multiple spinal surgeries, knee surgery, all of these sorts of things that end up developing a lot of scar tissue. So all of that really helped a lot, doing body work and movement. And then for me, getting back and exercising again, which was really a huge win for me. About, I would say, in May of last year, I got on my road bike for the first time in years, and I rode 10 or 15 miles incredibly slowly, and I thought, oh my God, this is incredible. I can actually ride a road bike again. And over the next 2 weeks, I rode every day progressively a little bit further, a little bit faster. And I thought, you know what, I'm gonna try to ride my mountain bike again. I dug up my old race bike from 1999, and I went out for a mountain bike ride, which is my favorite thing in the world, riding a mountain bike. There's nothing I enjoy more than that. And it was a revelation. I was going over drop-offs and jumping over logs and things that I never thought even 3 months before I would be able to do. So I promptly went out and spent a fortune on a brand new mountain bike.
Now, didn't you actually get back surgery at one point in your life?
I've had back surgery twice.
So you've had two back surgeries, but were those back surgeries done back when you were doing all these things like cycling and extreme exercising and adventuring and things of that nature?
Nope. All of that happened while I was really sick.
So I have a question for you. Would you have done anything differently like 10 years ago in your exercise routine or in your workout protocol to avoid getting those spinal surgeries? I mean, with what you've learned about movement and exercise, I mean, kind of going above and beyond just the gut stuff, you know, as far as your exercise routine, what have you learned? What would you have changed?
I think the main thing I would have changed, and I know that you're a big advocate of this, is getting away from just being in a single position and doing single repetitive motions. One of the challenging parts about cycling is that you're in one position for a very long period of time. And while it's good for certain muscle groups, it's not necessarily good for overall body mobility. I think if there's one thing that I could have, I've recently, and I say recently in the past 9 months, I've kind of discovered the squat. And the squat to me is, I think, something that would have saved my life. I don't think I would have had back surgery if I had been doing squats in my teens and 20s.
Just like back squats with a barbell on your back or different forms
all of squats? All kinds of squats. I mean, I think even more important than weighted squats are just the notion of squatting. If you think about any other culture in the world, they do almost everything in the squat, whether from you're going to the bathroom, giving birth, socializing, eating, cooking, planning a hunt. All of that happens in a squatted position. And most Americans can't get anywhere close to ass to grass. Mm-hmm. And I know that I certainly couldn't until very recently. Our hip flexors, our psoas, the front muscles of our body, which really play a huge role in supporting our spine, become atrophied and shortened by spending so much time in chairs, by spending so much time in supportive furniture, by not moving and getting in and out of that squatted position. And I think that one exercise and that one kind of modality would have really helped me prevent having back surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, kind of tying together this with the gut, it's interesting that a lot of times avoiding that squatting position can create quite a bit of colonic issues too, as things stay inside your large intestine for longer periods of time, that can create some toxicity issues in folks. And I've actually found with myself and with some of the folks who I coach that when you train your body to have like a morning bowel movement and you just make that happen, whether it's doing like magnesium and vitamin C in the morning, whether it's using one of these squatty potties or using a squatting position, but basically getting yourself into that habit, you actually feel a lot better during the day if you can get complete elimination in the morning. It's really, really interesting.
Oh yeah, I mean the squatty potty has changed my life. You know, it's an incredible, ridiculously simple device. But it the other thing that's great about
it. And by the way, for people who don't know what the squatty potty is, it's this little device that you just kind of you shove it up against your toilet, and it's this nice looking stool that you pull away from your toilet when you're ready to go to the bathroom, and allows you to get in a squatting position without, for example, like perching in a squatting position on top of the actual toilet bowl, which can be either uncomfortable or gross or both, or break the porcelain.
Yeah, it's the stool.
Yeah, exactly. So sorry to interrupt. What were you saying?
No, but I mean, the squatty potty is great, you know, and that I totally agree with you. And it's something that I got turned on to, I think, through your podcast last summer. And I've since bought them as gifts for people who think that it's kind of an odd gift, but then thank me and, write me months later telling me how much better they feel because they use it every day and they can't actually. I have one friend who now, when he travels, he takes his suitcase into the bathroom and uses it as a squatty potty because, he can't travel with his potty. But you're totally right. I mean, that squatting position, that's how we're designed to eliminate. It's how we evolved to eliminate. And that movement at the same time, it also does so much to stabilize your core. So it's one of those kind of functional movements that is that I think really would have helped me from having spinal surgery.
Yeah. So you turned your body around with gut healing supplements, with kind of fixing the diet, with what sounds like kind of an autoimmune protocol where you were eliminating, gluten, and I assume you made some adjustments as far as soy and dairy and eggs as well, or?
So for me, dairy and eggs, I actually think eggs are wonderful. Eggs are one of my favorite things in my diet. And dairy is something that certainly when I was going through the healing process, I eliminated, but then I've added back in, and I do bulletproof coffee in the morning. I'm a big fan of grass-fed butter.
You're able to add some of those things back in now that you've healed your gut?
Well, dairy, yes. Gluten, I'm not really interested in adding back in. It's one of those things that once it's an incredibly addictive substance. Once you've kind of broken the habit of eating it, and I think a lot of carbohydrates are the same way. When you've broken the habit of eating them, at least for me, I look at stuff that I would have craved a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, I now kind of look at that as being like a slippery slope back into what I call hellness, you know, from wellness to hellness. I don't want to go back there. So I'm not really interested in it. And then corn and soy, I mean, those are those are both inflammatory foods. So corn is something that, you know, it's hard for me to pass up sweet corn in the height of summer. Mm-hmm. We've got amazing corn around here, and I do love a really good handmade tortilla. And but I just eat it in very, you know, in moderation. So it's not something that doesn't form a big part of my diet.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point you make about gluten and addictive potential, because you get these gluten exorphins that are formed during the digestion of gluten, and those are opioid peptides. I mean, they're very similar to like opiate addictive drugs. So it's, you know, in for example, modern wheat that's bred for high yield crop, where you get really concentrated amounts of like wheat germ gluten, and that can be, you know, Wonder Bread can be incredibly addictive, as can pasta and all the other derivatives used from that wheat. So you are a chef, and I would be remiss not to, when I have a world-class chef on the podcast, start to talk about how we can actually heal our gut and address inflammatory issues, or make sure that we're not creating inflammatory issues, but not feel like we're eating cardboard. So I know you have a cookbook, and of course I'll link to that in the show notes if people want to check out your Hero Food cookbook. But can you start to share with some of our listeners some easy recipes that they could get started with that are just safe, but also kind of delicious, that maybe go above and beyond just like, I don't know, drinking coconut milk or something?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, well, coconut milk is great, and I'm a big fan of everything coconut.
It just gets old sometimes all by itself.
It does get a little old, yeah. Although I slather it on my body in copious amounts, and well, the oil at least. But yeah, there's so much great stuff that you can eat that is really, really good for you and full of good fats and full of good anti-inflammatory properties that are delicious. And it sometimes does take a little bit of thinking outside the box. I mean, one thing that I love to make, and it's a really simple kind of condiment that you can have around, but you can also use it to fold into, if you do eat rice, you can fold it into some rice, or if you you can spread it on some grilled steaks. It's a kale pesto, and you just use a good, I mean, if you've got a Vitamix, or you have a Magic Bullet, or you can do it in a Magic Bullet, you can do it in Vitamix, any food processor will work really well with a high speed. It's literally just kale and anchovies and your favorite nuts, if you want to use them. I actually like putting macadamia nuts in it because I think they've got great oil, and they're one of my favorite nuts to cook with. A little bit of olive oil, some vinegar, and if you want to throw in some hard cheese, you can throw in some hard cheese, and you pulse that up, season it with salt and pepper, maybe a little dried chili, and you have this incredible pesto. But it's made with kale, which is obviously a dark leafy green, and it's got all sorts of great stuff in it. You've got anchovies, so you're getting good fats, you're getting good omega-3s. Mm. You've got macadamia, again, you've got another great fat. You've got olive oil, great fat. A little bit of vinegar, which really, if you want to go, you know, take it to the next level, you can use a living vinegar like a Bragg's or something like that has the mother in it. And then you've got this incredible kind of superfood that is a condiment you can use.
Bragg's makes a living vinegar with a mother in it, like kombucha.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep. I
and you can just get
day.
That at the grocery store from Bragg's brand vinegar. Or?
Yep. They're apple cider vinegar with the mother, has a mother in the bottom. We use it to start other vinegars. So when we make vinegars at the restaurant, we use we actually use that mother as the starter for our vinegars. Very cool. And then the Bragg's, I have like three bottles in the house. I have one bottle in the shower. So when I wake up in the morning and I'm taking my shower and doing my hot and cold contrast showers, I take a swig of Bragg's apple cider vinegar, and then I use it, you know, maybe twice a week to actually wash my body with it, so that I'm balancing my external microbiota, if you will.
Can you get that online, or is that more like a health food store? You get
from Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah, I get it.
I'll take some notes here. I'll get some notes for people, the things like the Squatty Potty and the apple cider vinegar, and maybe some of the recipes you send over in your books. Yeah. Folks can check this stuff out. I'm taking notes as you go.
Cool.
Okay, cool. So we've got kale pesto.
Kale pesto.
Can you give us a couple of others?
Sure. I mean, if you're down with eggs, which I'm down with eggs, as long as they're from a really good source, and that's something that, I mean, this is a whole other conversation. We could have a whole podcast about labeling and what the difference is between pasture-raised and cage-free and vegetarian feed and all this stuff. In my opinion, if you, your best bet is to try to find someone who has chickens, or better yet, have your own chickens, which is a little challenging in New York City, but I do know some people that do it. And just, I mean, chickens, first of all, they're not vegetarian. So I think it's kind of odd to feed them a corn and soy based vegetarian diet, even if that is organic, and then label it as something that's healthy. So if you can find chickens from a farmer's market that are really literally free range chickens that are out in a pasture eating bugs and grubs, with a natural diet, that's the chicken you want to be eating, and that's the egg you want to be eating. So some eggs that are just soft scrambled, and what I do when I make scrambled eggs very frequently. So what I do with scrambled eggs in the morning is I'll take maybe three really good eggs, I'll lightly whisk them up. I'll put a couple of knobs of grass fed butter from a local dairy that we have here in upstate New York right into the eggs while it's cold. And if you do it with the butter cold into the eggs when you're scrambling. We have a fire.
I'm sorry. It sounds like my home is burning down.
Oh no!
But that's okay. Everything's fine. That was a quick one. Quick fire.
Good.
Sorry, folks. That just for our listeners, that probably won't even be edited out. But there you go. So sorry about that. Seamus, you're talking about the eggs.
Yeah. So if you add some cold grass fed butter into the eggs, mm-hmm. when you go to scramble the eggs in the pan. The butter will just slowly melt and it'll actually emulsify with the eggs and we'll get a really creamy egg versus like nice. Separating the fat. So we've got some butter, we've got some good eggs, a little salt. I'll then add in some chia seeds and I'll let that bloom for a couple of minutes in the eggs before I scramble it. Maybe take a clove of garlic and grate it on a microplane into the eggs. And then I'll add a little bit of some greens in there. I mean, if I have kale, I'll just mince it up really fine. Finally, maybe throw in some mustard greens, any bright green that I just want to gently cook a little bit in the eggs, and then melt some butter and olive oil in a cast iron pan, medium low heat, and just slowly scramble the eggs. And I always use a rubber spatula when I'm doing it so that I can get all the eggs off from the bottom of the pan. Mm-hmm. And then just throw in some avocado at the end, and you've got an incredible, very fat laden, great protein, good veg. Breakfast that's or lunch. I mean, this is, I typically don't really eat breakfast. I'll have this when I come home from a bike ride, maybe late morning, like 11:30 or so. Yeah.
Love it. For the folks who are out there working out, exercising, who are maybe going out for long periods of time and want something non-inflammatory, something kind of real food-ish that they can use mm-hmm. before or during their exercise session, do you have anything like that that you take out with you on your bike rides?
Yeah, and one of the things that I do is I actually take coconut oil with me on my bike ride, and if I'm riding in a fasted state, which I'll usually do, is I'll start my workout in a fasted state. So I'll have, I mean, not a true fasted state because I'm having bulletproof coffee, and I'll take branched chain amino acids before I go out, and then I'll go for a ride. And on my ride, as I am kind of fueling along the way, I'll have some coconut oil in a little squeeze tube. I'll take macadamia nuts, beef jerky. I'm a big advocate of eating real food on the bike. I'm not a professional competitor. I'm not an elite athlete. I'm just out there trying to hammer and go as hard as I can. So I also want to make sure it tastes good. So I'll take stuff like that. I stay away from the dried fruit. I stay away from the energy bars and things like that are going to really affect my sugar levels. And I've really noticed in the past 9 months to a year, because I check my blood sugar periodically. I was doing it really, really frequently. And now I don't need to do it quite as frequently as I've been able to dial in my diet. But I did notice for a long time, if I ate more carbohydrates the day before a workout, I would need to eat more carbohydrates and get more sugar in my body when I was working out. Otherwise, I would feel, I'd feel the glycemic spike, and then I'd feel myself kind of crash, and I'd have that feeling of bonking. Mm-hmm. I haven't bonked since becoming really a fat burner. I haven't bonked at all, so I can go out and do. I mean, last week I did a 75-mile ride with a group of guys, and we were riding hard, and I didn't eat anything during that whole ride.
Yeah,
and it was fat. And I felt fine.
It sounds like you've really kind of tapped into almost like that biohack of fat adaptation and turning yourself into a fat burning machine and being able to get away with, you know, just a little bit of coconut oil and something like that during the long sessions. And that kind of leads me to another question that I wanted to ask you, because I know that you listen to this show and you probably have used some of the, you know, quote unquote biohacks that I've talked about, but you're also, you're preparing for, I believe, are they mountain biking races that you're preparing for?
Yeah. I mean, the big one that I'm preparing for is called La Ruta de los Conquistadores. And it's a 3-day mountain bike stage race in Costa Rica. And it starts on the Pacific coast in Jaco, and then it goes and ends on the Atlantic coast in Limon. So it's 3 days. It's about 60 to 70 miles a day, but it's all off-road. But the real challenge is that it's 29,000 feet of climbing over 3 days.
Nice.
So it's a lot. It's a really intense ride.
So what kind of things have been kind of working for you in your prep for that? And I know you're doing one other event. You told me about it. It South Africa? Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually next year. I'm doing it before kind of leading up to Costa Rica. I'm doing quite a few local races. Like I'm doing next month, I'm doing a 50-mile single track mountain bike race. I'm doing in May the Grand Fondo New York, which is a 100-mile road race. And so I'll be doing periodic races. Maybe once a month, I'll probably be doing like an endurance race as I lead up to November, which is when the race in Costa Rica is. And as I get closer, I'll do a few 2 or 3 day back-to-back hard efforts just to get ready for that race. But then next spring, in March of 2015, is the ABSA Cape Epic, which is kind of the granddaddy of all epic endurance mountain bike races. And it goes across South Africa. It's about 700 kilometers. So that's a serious race. And so in many ways, I think La Ruta, even though La Ruta is going to be incredibly hard, that's sort of like the warm up for it.
Yeah. So. Aside from fat adaptation, any other biohacks from an exercise standpoint or a nutrition standpoint that you're finding to be effective right now?
Well, one of the things that I've really been amazed by is the power lung. And I've been using that quite a bit. I use it at least twice a day. And I've been able to see on a lot of the climbs that, you know, a climb that historically even a week prior using power lung was challenging for me.
And for folks who don't know what that is, it's a spring-loaded resisted breathing device that you use typically not when you're exercising, but like when you're in your car or sedentary.
Exactly. And that, you know, I've been able to see also in looking at charting where my heart rate is on you know, one specific climb that I use is a good test base for me, because I know how long it takes me to climb it. I know exactly where my heart rate's going to be throughout the climb based upon my effort and what my wattage is and everything. And I can look at that and see major progress week to week that I know is above and beyond just my fitness improving, that it's coming from greater anaerobic strength aerobic strength from using the power lung. So that's been a pretty cool device. I've been using earthing sheets for about 8 months or so.
Mm-hmm. Earthing sheets.
Yeah.
And those you're putting on your bed and then plugging into the grounded outlet on the wall?
Yep.
And what do you notice when you use those?
Well, I sleep a lot better. I have much more kind of deeper sleep. Yeah, as I track my sleep, it seems as though I'm spending more time in REM. I'm getting less interrupted sleep, and when I do wake up, I fall back to sleep much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helped me. One of the things that's been kind of challenging.
Got to get you on the biomat, man. Eventually,
yeah, I know. I really want to.
It's even more natural than like an earthing sheet, because you still get some electrical pollution, like some dirty pollution, at least in the United States, when you're using an earthing sheet. And the biomat actually has an EMF blocker built into the unit that travels between the electrical outlet and the mat itself. Huge. And I finally, for the first time last night, got my wife to sleep on it. So,
oh yeah,
there you go.
it doesn't cover the whole bed. It's just sort of under your area of the bed, or how does it work?
You put it underneath the, well, what I do is I put it underneath the comforter. And so I've got one comforter on top of the biomat, then a sheet on top of me, then a blanket on top of that. So there's a little bit of padding between me and the biomat. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah,
and,
no, I got to
sorry, you're going to mention something else.
Well, the only other thing I was going to mention, which is not really a specific biohack, but it's a challenge for me because I have to travel quite a bit. And as you can tell, I'm a little stuffy right now, and that's a direct result of traveling. Every time, I was telling you before the podcast, every time I fly on an old plane, an MD-80, the past four times I've flown on an MD-80, I've gotten sick.
Those are the ones that don't have the HEPA filter on them.
There's no real filtration system, and so you're getting just kind of recycled stale air. Yeah. And what's really bizarre to me is that every time that this has happened, I have been able to feel the instant I got sick. I'd take a breath in and I suddenly feel something out of sorts in my throat. And I know in that moment that I'm getting sick. So, I foolishly this last trip, which was a very short trip, I thought, oh, you know what? I've been doing so well with all my travel hacks to avoid jet lag and to keep from getting sick because I've been traveling a lot for the past 6 months and I haven't gotten sick at all. Except for when I do these short trips on these old planes. But I thought, oh, I'll be fine. And then, of course, I flew and I got sick. But one of the things that's been really amazing for me is figuring out how to kind of overcome jet lag. And that's made it easy for me so that when I am, like, say, flying to Europe, to hit the ground in the morning and immediately do a workout at 9 o'clock in the morning and feel good. And then by 10 o'clock at night, I'm on European time and I've fallen asleep and I feel fine.
Mm. Interesting.
So that's been really, really cool. Have you used these no jet lag pills?
I have used no jet lag before, and they work really well if you take them according to instructions, is what I found. So as soon as the flight leaves, and then about every 2 hours during the flight, and then when you land. And yeah, it's a homeopathic Asian remedy designed. I found them in the Hong Kong airport for the first time in like a Chinese herbal medicine outlet and tried them. And they've actually got a lot of kind of things that are traditionally used as like neurotropics and smart drugs and brain anti-inflammatories in them, which is, I suspect, why they work, you know, club moss and things of that nature. But yeah, right. They actually, for international flights, I like those.
Do you think it's because they're because of the EMF waves that they're blocking out, or they're helping you deal with them? Is that part of the equation when it comes to dealing with jet lag from them? Because I have to think that, you know, I house like three or four boxes of seaweed before I fly, and I think that really helps.
Yeah, it can help to shut down some of the inflammation that results from solar radiation. But, you know, I suspect part of it is simply regulation of circadian rhythms and some of the neural inflammation that can happen just by traveling across multiple time zones as well. So probably a combination. But yeah, man, we could keep going on for a while, I think. What I want to know, though, for folks who are listening in who maybe just want to go visit one of your restaurants and taste some of your food, where can people go right now if they happen to be in an area where you're at and they just want to taste some of your cooking?
Sure, absolutely. In New York City, you can come to either of my two restaurants, Tertulia, and the website is tertulianyc.com. That's TERTULIANYC.com. You can probably put that in the show notes. And the other one is El Colmado, and that is a tapas bar. So the two are both Spanish restaurants. I lived in Spain for a number of years, and while we don't bill either restaurant as being a paleo restaurant or a health food restaurant per se, you'll find that there are, for people that are conscientious about how they eat, there's a lot of offerings there, and we're scrupulous about where our products come from and our ingredients come from. We have relationships with farms throughout the Northeast, and everything is seasonal and locally sourced. So when if you're concerned with eating well, they're really great places to come. And they're both very fun restaurants. And I've got a few other projects that are in the works.
So if I pull those up on like Yelp or Urban Spoon, they're going to be okay?
Oh, yeah. You'll find them.
Just making sure.
You'll find them. Yep, absolutely.
Okay, cool. And what else were you going to say?
So I've got a couple other projects coming on board. One in Europe, which will be open this summer. And I can't really talk about that quite yet, but it is the reason for me traveling back and forth a lot. And that'll be announced probably another month or so.
How do you spell? I've got the Tertulia pulled up because I'm putting links in the show notes for anyone who lives in the New York area. I've got the Tertulia one pulled up. But how do you spell the other one?
The other one is El Colmado, so it's E L C C O L M A D O. So it's two words.
El Colmado. And it means
the grocer.
Okay.
And the URL is El Colmado NYC. elcamanonyc.com.
Okay, elcamanonyc.com. Got it. Okay, well, fantastic. This was a great time, and I hope that this will be really helpful to folks. And of course, if you have questions or comments or feedback, or you want to check out anything that we talked about, then head over to bengreenfieldfitness.com. Check out the show notes for this episode. If you can't find them because you're listening to this at a date much later than when the podcast comes out or something like that, you can just do a search for Seamus Mullen. You spell his first name, S-E-A-M-U-S, Seamus, and Mullen, M-U-L-L-E-N. And you can also, of course, Google him and find his website and everything as well. So Seamus Mullen. All right. Well, Seamus, thank you so much for coming on the call today.
Thank you, Ben. It's been great. It's awesome. So glad to be here.
All right, folks. Until next time, this is Ben Greenfield and Seamus Mullen signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Visit BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.